Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, the Media Project gets underway once again with the music from Pete Seeger that sort of categorizes the media in the grand old days, and we're going to bring back some of that in our conversation today because we got some grand old people here. This is Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, by way of introducing Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Hi, Rex.
A senior fellow in the room today by many measures, Alan. I don't just mean
many years.
Not meaning to.
Not only age.
Yes, no.
You wouldn't want to
not.
Be accused of ages.
Only man with a PhD in the room. Ira Fussfeld is here, the longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
Hello, nice to be back.
And speaking of Pete, he referred to publishers as guilty of prestitution.
What about retired publishers?
Yeah, them, not so much.
We lay back on our laurels.
And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. Did I say that already? I was out at a party last week, by the way, where some very nice people out by Cooperstown who listened to this program at 93.3 in Canajoharie, New York, were saying nice things about it. They said, you know, we should be on the air for a full hour. And that's what they said. And I said, no, we can't do that because we are journalists, and the journalists tend to be a couple inches deep and about a mile wide.
And we have jobs.
Do more than that. And we have jobs, yes.
But, you know, speaking of which, Rex, we do have a station in Cooperstown. It's one of the smaller stations, but I suspect that's where.
You think that's where these nice folks are listening? On
97.3 in Cooperstown.
Well, there you go. So you never know. It's a good thing anyway. We welcome listeners all over the place, even in southern Indiana and Texas and Ohio and wherever you may hear us. So obviously this week we need to talk about media coverage of the attacks in France, the issues that are raised by some of that. I think most Americans got a lot of their news by watching cable television, and I would say that this is where cable in the short run does great work because they are there on the ground quickly, and you can get a lot of information from a lot of people very fast.
Except. Because of the nature of the event and the importance of the event and their desire, rightly so, to be essentially wall-to-wall, it still affords them too much time where they have nothing really to say and nothing new to say. And naturally, there are new audiences coming on throughout the day, so very few people are watching, and so you do need to be repetitive. But so much, inevitably, as it does with other major cable news coverage stories, results in speculation and people, you know, reporters interviewing reporters with really not advancing the story. And I'm not sure I know whether I would be able to do anything differently, but it is, I think, a shortcoming of the coverage.
Well, you know, it's so interesting that you say that, Ira, as usually profound. When I hear that 123 people are dead, I grieve for it. I hate it. I project myself into it, but I sure don't go watch them say 123 people for the next 5 hours. And I can tell you this, you know, I don't want to. I mean, I feel so bad about it. I don't want to get immersed in watching some guy with a trench coat, you know, on the corner, if they still wear trench coats. But one last thing, and then I'll shut up. And that is, and you say, I doubt that, right?
Right. It seems unlikely.
I just think, right? Seems unlikely. No, but I just think when WAMC learned of it immediately, we went directly to the BBC, who did a better job and faster than NPR did.
How do you know?
Well, because they were there. We couldn't get NPR to do anything for it. Ah. You know, we picked up NPR later in the evening, but BBC was right there at the moment, and that's how we know.
I was taken by this piece that our producer sent us, written by a guy named James Warren, who I'm sure Rex is familiar with, longtime newspaper man in the Chicago market. And this was after the raid that the police made to try to capture the missing gunman. And he said he was watching TV. There were reports of a shooting. Early on, the cable networks appeared to compete to see which third-string late-night anchors could disseminate the most unconfirmed data the fastest. It was live TV at its most unavoidable and precarious. It was going to a scene live with nobody having much of a clue about what was actually happening for a very long time.
Okay, so Ira, what would you have them do?
I think that you have to resist the speculation. You have to report what you know is happening, which is there is a raid of some sort going on. Here's where it is. Here's what we actually see, because we can confirm with what we see. And beyond that, we're not really sure what's going
and
on.
And here's who we think they're after. That's a fair, isn't
that's
it?
That's speculation.
No, it's not.
Unless they have a confirmation. It could have been a whole other cell that they were going after. It didn't necessarily mean that it were the people involved, because remember, the initial reports was the so-called mastermind had already fled to Belgium.
Let me disagree with you and tell you that when every one of these cable stations and everybody else comes up with something, somebody is leaking to them that that's who they're after.
Well, maybe. That's probably true that they've got a source saying this is it, but the source may not be good, you know? And the problem is, I think you're both putting your finger on it, that when you have to fill a certain amount of airtime, you kind of go with what you've got, that old journalism axiom. And the problem is that you would end up being repeating yourself over and over again if you're on cable television. And if you don't engage in any speculation, you don't have anything at all to say, I think.
That's right. And that's where, when it comes to your favorite topic, news literacy, if people are watching these programs, they have to take it with a grain of salt that they may not be hearing what is accurate. All they're hearing is either speculation or the very beginning of a story that may change by the end of the story. Look what happened the other night when two planes had emergency landings because there were fear of bombs on board. And then for at least an hour that I noticed, because I kept switching back and forth, all three cable news channels had split-screen pictures of these planes on the tarmac. And there really wasn't much. All you could see was flashing lights and dark.
Well,
darkness.
Of course you would do that. I mean, nature abhors a vacuum. You know that. We all know that. You know, Rex has the ability to think things through and to make sure that what he has on the front page, is correct.
Well, yes, except nowadays, you know, of course, we have the immediate deadline. We're reaching an increasing share of our readers by digital,
sure.
And so we have the immediate deadline problem, too. And in this kind of a situation, we just go with whatever we're fed by other wire services. We don't have our own reporters that we're dispatching to Paris.
You guys have televisions up on the wall, do you?
We do. We have little TV sets all over the newsroom.
Yep,
that makes a difference.
So instead of them exclusively stealing from you, now every once in a while you steal from them.
Now we get tips. The problem is that we have to actually go out and get the stories. They can just, you know, rewrite what we publish.
And that's not a new... I remember when I started at my paper in 1970, we were an afternoon paper, so nobody worked the overnight shift. And the first reporter who would come in the morning at 6 a.m. was the cops reporter. And the first thing he would do is turn on the local radio station. We didn't have local TV.
That's so interesting. We've got guys here who do the same thing. We never report that. But I think it's ingrained in them to keep that thing on.
But to Rex's point, if there was a tip on the radio station that said such and such happened last night, then we would go out and do the reporting. Whereas often, not at this fine radio station, but often the radio stations just read the stories out of the newspapers without even crediting
them
frequently.
Well, that's an interesting point that you're making, Ira. I think that more and more we have all begun to credit the sources as opposed to pretending we got it ourselves.
There are some who are, I think you're right. Some people do.
I mean, I think it's a part of our credo here that you always... And so what? What? You say, as reported in the Times Union this morning, what? Somebody's going to say, they didn't do that themselves,
You've heard me tell this story. There was the definition of news theft. If a radio station sees a story in the newspaper that it's actually convinced is correct, it will not credit the newspaper. If it's not quite sure if it's correct, it'll say, according to published reports. And if it really is fearful that it's wrong, it'll say, according to the Times Union.
Right. But by the way, I think that is changing. I do. I know that you're right about that. That's the way it used to be. But I think now, you know, with the aggregators, taking all the stuff, and nobody seems to care that they got it from somewhere else. You get the feeling, that's good. They're They're cooperating with each other.
You know, contemporary codes of ethics in journalism have been revised now also to say not only do you attribute your source, but you actually link to it.
Right,
that is really the only fair thing to do, is to link to the original source of material, whether it's raw documents or whether it is another news organization. You know, on this question of what the cable channels, just back to the original topic for a second, what they're doing, what is so objectionable, and this has been pointed out by the Huffington Post media editor, Gabriel Arana, who pointed out that there is a significant amount of Islamophobic media coverage that has gone on cable channels. CNN anchor saying, you know, why isn't the Muslim community stepping forward, and which they have? You know, why aren't the Muslims in this world denouncing it, which they have? It's really kind of outrageous.
Well, you know, Rex, we have a program. Anybody could listen to it, of course, online, but it's called The Roundtable. And then we have one in the afternoon, which is called Vox Pop. And on Vox Pop, people get to say anything they want. They can call up and they can give their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have a rather, I think, fairly center-left audience.
Do you think?
Center-left audience.
That's
and so usually you get the politically correct stuff over and over again. Not on this. It's amazing how many people were calling up. And by the way, it was more traffic than we have ever seen, as measured by our Ray Graff, who was in charge of such things. He showed me the graph, and it was astounding how many people really were concerned about it. But one after another, people were calling up and saying, why don't those Muslim men join the army and go back and fight back there? And of course, there was Jeb Bush's wonderful comment that we should accept Christian Syrians and not Muslim Syrians.
A number of the presidential candidates now have said that. You know,
yeah,
let's bring in the, let's allow in the Christians and so on. And I don't know, do your listeners share that sentiment?
I don't know, but I know it's the most conservative number of phone calls when it comes to letting Muslims into the country that I have ever heard or ever seen.
Do you think that the collective media should be blamed for that attitude on the part of the many in the country that you just described, but blaming Muslims for something that Muslims in general are not responsible for? In other words, is the media not doing a good job explaining? Does the media believe it and thus is just reflecting what the public is saying?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, certainly the response in the Muslim community to Islamist attacks has not been covered extensively, but how often can you say 120 leaders of the Muslim community signed a letter or I don't know how much of that you can do, because you can't do the same story over and over again. And it's a wonder we don't have the same kind of expectation of American Christian leaders when you see for the Oklahoma City attack, for example, which was done by a devout Christian. That was terrorism done by an American Christian. And we didn't have the similar expectation. Why didn't the churches rise up about this, right? I don't know that you could blame the media for failing to give enough credence or enough coverage to the mainstream Muslim response.
Well,
to
is this also another case where the media on the right is much louder and is thus dominating the debate?
True, certainly true.
Well, Americans care about their safety, their personal safety. They care about the safety of their families, and this goes directly to that. So, you know, in the same way that politicians stick their hands up in the wind and see which way the wind is blowing, and in order to win a Republican primary, for example, want to outdo everybody else, and they do it, I think that the media, to some degree, wants to be fair about this. I'm talking about the responsible media. I'm not talking about Fox. And they want to be fair about it, and they also want to judge what the expectations of their readers and their listeners are.
Now, what about the question here that I've heard other people complain about as well, that the media cover Paris more aggressively than the somewhat very briefly earlier attack in Beirut, or in fact 147 people killed at the college in Kenya?
Or Nigeria.
Absolutely, Nigeria. Yes, absolutely. So here's the shorthand is, why didn't the media cover, you know, insert country here? Why wasn't this story shared as extensively on my Facebook feed? You may as well.
I suspect you know the answer. I suspect the answer is that the French are more like us. The historic allies, we can project ourselves into their situation, and it's harder to do with third world countries. Now, there will be somebody, and I want to warn you about this, who writes me right now and says, you said that that's what should be, that we should pay more attention to the French. I did not. I'm just trying to explain exactly why I think it happens that way.
I think I would generally agree with that. In using air quotes, the Paris attacks are more of a local story in this country. An attack on the West is more of a local story. An attack on a major city that many Americans have been to and can relate to. And it's not unlike, and I don't mean to understate it, but it's not unlike if there is a crime in Seattle, Washington, it's going to get much bigger play in the Northwest than it is going to be here on the East Coast. And I think for many of those same reasons.
It depends on the level of the crime.
It depends on the level of the crime, sure. But even if there was a horrific crime in Seattle, Washington today, it would be covered nationally, and then it would go away within 24 hours, whereas in the Seattle, Washington area, it'll be reported for weeks, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Also, the attacks in Paris demonstrate that ISIS can project its power into a Western democracy. Paris is a lot like New York City.
Right.
And so this does have more immediate relevance for Americans. And you know, I think it's also true, and people are, folks will take offense at this, but the fact is we are all created equal. That is enunciated in the charter of our nation. We don't all die equally. People, this is a reality of news coverage because it's a reality of the way we lead our lives, that some people die in circumstances that just become more newsworthy. And I hear this all the time from people questioning why we put certain people's deaths on the front page or on the cover of our metropolitan section and so on. And it is because newsworthiness is not so easily done. It's a subjective judgment, but I think that this is one that, this is, you just look at the level of response, look at the people responding. It's that the media are responding to a public interest, not dictating what the people ought to be taking a look at.
Although the media has to be ready to start adjusting, and maybe should have already started adjusting, because many of the people who were murdered in Beirut may well have connections in the West now because of the immigration. And I'm not talking about this current immigration crisis, but the face of this country has changed dramatically. And so there is more interest, I would think, and there will be increasingly amount of interest in the Middle East here in this country.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Ira Fussfeld, and Rex Smith here from Albany. If you want to share your point of view, we are media@wamc.org. media@wamc.org. By the way, there was a nice note from somebody. I missed last week's show. I wasn't here, but somebody wrote a note saying how good the show was, and they thought it no offense to me, he said, that had nothing to do with my absence. But
I got that subtlety, and I wrote him right back, and I said, we love Rex. He's the best.
I thought he was being serious. I thought you thought he was being sarcastic, that he thought it was better because I was gone, huh?
Well, I don't know.
I take offense.
I don't know. I defend my friends.
Thank you. I do appreciate
it. Rosemary,
that.
who sat in your chair, has a very large following.
Uh-huh.
Yes, she has really become a rock star in this.
No, she's a rock star.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. How about that?
Deservedly so.
Well, there you go.
We love Rex, Ira.
Credit where it is due.
That's Rex. We love Rex. Do you love Ira or do you love Rex?
No, we love you
Rex,
too.
Okay, come,
good.
Ira.
That's what I was looking for.
Najibullah Qureshi is an Afghan-born journalist, did a remarkable thing last week. He reported from inside ISIS-held territory in Afghanistan for a PBS Frontline documentary. I think we just have to stop for a moment and take note of this, just because reporting within ISIS is extraordinarily dangerous. It requires a level of reporting perseverance and bravery, an ability to talk to people, get them to come over to you. You know, we think it's difficult for sources to get politicians in this country to talk to them. Imagine what Najibullah Qureshi had to go through to make this happen. And kudos to PBS for supporting the kind of journalism that enables people to be seeing how children, toddlers, are being taught to handle automatic weapons, and how generations of people who will engage in this holy war against the West are being trained. Now we have a clear vision inside that, thanks to this strong reporting from PBS Frontline.
Amen. Could we just for a moment, Rex, go to state politics?
Please.
I'm fascinated. In New York State, where this broadcast originates, two of the top leaders are on trial for their political existence and potential incarceration, right? Shelley Silver, the former speaker, and Dean Skelos, the former head guy in the Senate. Now, why is this a media issue? Because it turns out that a good deal of their phone calls, especially Skelos, have been faithfully recorded by the authorities and put out online in every other place. Now, Rex, Ira, I'd love to know whether or not it is the job of the press to be taking basically purloined or other, you know, conversations from, how would you like it if everything you ever said off the record to a colleague or to a friend said, that guy's really a jerk, or, you know, I'm going to run against him for a political office. There seems to me to be something tawdry about the whole thing.
Well, of course, the tapes were obtained pursuant to a judge's order because of a prima facie case that there was a crime committed. So, you know.
Yeah, and but they were played in open court.
Yes, that's true, Ira. And what you both say is true. On the other hand, it is also so, I think, that you guys engage in conversations all the time to other people. And if it's relevant, sure. If the guy says, I offered him a bribe if he did that, I get it. But if the guy says, that guy's a jerk and I'm going to run against him for political office and,
well, you
know,
have
this
point.
Kind of thing.
Here's where I think you have a point. The prosecution is not so subtly leaking this kind of information, or making, I shouldn't say leaking, because they've offered it up there as some of their evidence, and they're probably including a little bit more of the conversation than they would need to make their case, because their goal is to beat up their opponents, in this case, the defendants.
Right.
But I think that it's newsworthy. I think
it's newsworthy.
Guys behave,
people want to hear it.
Yeah.
It turns out, if one listens, one can make value judgments, that Dean Skelos' son, about whom this is all, is a jerk. you know, and that he says some very stupid things. But does one want to convict on the basis of a jerk? Being a jerk, or
there'd be an awful lot of politicians behind bars in that case, right?
A lot of strange things can happen in court. Did you see the case of the reputed mobster who supposedly was involved in the famous Lufthansa hijack almost 30 years ago or more?
The guy's 80 years old.
The event that spawned the movie Goodfellas, and he was acquitted.
He was acquitted, and they had all kinds of evidence and everything else. The jury didn't take long to acquit him.
And had it not been for that movie, by the way, I don't think there would have been as much news coverage as there was.
But they had a story prior to the verdict in the New York Times where, without them having the benefit of talking back to the story, there just seemed to be no question that this guy was going to be found guilty.
Well,
so you never know what's going to happen with Frank Skelos and with Sheldon Silver. And as we sit here, I'm reading that they may not even put up a defense.
I'm told that the Silver people are not going to put people
and,
up.
And you read that into what? That they feel that they've got no case?
Quite frequently, that's what people do when they say to the judge, look, judge, this whole thing is really stupid. They didn't prove anything.
Right.
And we're not going to rise to this and answer.
I mean,
one thing that has happened as a result of Preparara's magnificent work on this is that the top of the sewer has been taken off. And we all have had a good deep smell as to how things we always suspected have gone on have actually gone on.
Right. You know, for a journalist, you're always hoping that a case will pop out a lot of documents that you can use. In any time that a case is progressing toward trial, you can really cross your fingers that some cool stuff will be introduced into evidence or will be filed with the court in support of affidavits. Because once that is an official court document, you can quote from it without fear of a lawsuit. Yeah, you're not libeling anybody. So this gives us, as you said, Alan, gives us insight into the process, and that's really valuable for our readers to know.
No, except that it's the press process, and then, of course, there's also the legal process.
Well, and then at the end of the trial, these two trials, if one or both of these guys are found not guilty, will they have a right to go up in front of the microphones, as did Ray Donovan, the former Secretary of Labor, who was acquitted in a trial, and he said, where do I get back my reputation?
Good point.
Right. Not guilty does not always mean innocent.
Right.
Well, I've fought this out with you guys so many times, I'm not going to get into it. What? You found not guilty. It sounds to me like you're innocent.
No.
Give me OJ's number.
Right. We'll take it off the microphone, gentlemen. Take it off. All right. That's enough of the media project for this week. Dr. Alan Shartok of Northeast Public Radio.
Not guilty.
Ira Fussfeld from the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York.
I love Cooperstown.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place. I do too. Rex Smith from the Times Union. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you next week. Anytime, by the way, WAMC.org.
All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the bill. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.